Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, we are on the brink of perhaps the most anticipated special election for a United States Senate seat of our lifetimes.
Well, you can make jokes about it if you want,
and
but
I do.
This is a significant Senate race, not because for no other reason. If Martha Coakley loses on Tuesday, January 19th.
Bye-bye healthcare.
Right, because Scott Brown becomes Republican number 41.
Which, do you think he would be willing to vote for the health care bill?
Well, one, he says he won't, but his
he says he won't. Three, he says it every hour.
And yet, I guarantee that the Democratic officials in Massachusetts will not seat Scott Brown until they vote in Washington on health care.
Okay, now here's the question. Don't the Democrats need 60 votes?
Yes.
In other words, it's not just a matter of the Republicans coming up with 41. The Democrats have to have 60. So they're going to have to keep Paul Kirk in place.
Yes.
Even after a successor who actually has the imprimatur of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the people, the voters, they're going to have to keep Paul Kirk in there as an appointee week after week while the Republicans pound the table, pound the walls, and say, wait a minute, where is our elected representative of the Commonwealth?
Yeah.
Well, yes, I believe they are.
Except we do know that because of absentee ballots, because of overseas ballots, because of the ballot of Easy Rider, it could take a month before a successor, a new senator, is sworn in. And so that's the excuse, or actually that's a legitimate excuse.
There is a mechanical and technical way in which the Democrats are right. But consider the optics, as we said during the campaign. This is going to look like essentially the Democrats are holding out the elected representative of the people, who will have, if he wins, been elected essentially on an upswelling of resistance to the Democratic majority, specifically on the question of health care.
Well, we can talk about Martha Coakley's weaknesses in a second.
But it isn't just
But here's the best part of this. Remember when Ted Kennedy died, how quickly they changed the rule to get an appointee in because, you know, they needed 60 votes, how quickly they did it. And now if Scott Brown wins, but here's the PS to all this, Scott Brown is not going to win.
All right. And you say this with confidence because?
Democrats outnumber Republicans 3-1 in Massachusetts.
Yes, but that's a very deceiving statistic because it implies that that means that there are lots and lots and lots and lots of Democrats. It just means there aren't very many Republicans.
There are
none. Majority, the bare majority of all people in the Commonwealth are, quote, unenrolled.
Right.
Which is a very strange way of saying independent.
Non-affiliated voters, that's what they have in a lot of states. They're registered unaffiliated. And the Rasmussen poll, which of course a lot of Democrats question the methodology.
It's a robo poll. Right? And also it has a very tight likely voter screen.
Right.
They're essentially trying to get down to the people who would vote in a special election, which this is,
right,
which makes it somewhat logical, but it also excludes a lot of younger people, a lot of people of color.
It also shows, that Rasmussen poll shows that Scott Brown has a 2-1 lead among the unaffiliated voters.
There you go.
Now, the Boston Globe poll last Sunday, which had Martha Coakley with a 15-point lead, had it very, very close among independents with Martha Coakley holding a slight lead.
Now, if that is not true, if the Boston Globe is counting too many people who are not likely voters, okay, and that's my suspicion, then it all becomes a question of who has the better vision of the actual electorate on that magical election day, January 19th. Is it the tighter screen that says only certain kinds of people vote in special elections? Or is it the Boston Globe broader screen that says, no, this is a big election and we got to talk about a larger kind of turnout?
A lot of it is style. Scott Brown seems to be a more relaxed campaigner, campaigning with a smile. Of course, he's an attractive candidate. He was a centerfold for Cosmopolitan back in 1982.
Let's face it, that was a few years ago. Yeah. Not that he doesn't still look good, but it's used to characterize him as some sort of flighty boy.
Well,
he was 28 years ago.
He was doing it to pay off law school bills. But Martha Coakley is kind of a stiff campaigner. Since the December 8th primary, she has been very basically coasting.
On the other hand, with Martha Coakley's defense in mind here, I mean, it's the month of December. It's Christmas time. A lot of people have other things on their mind. You don't really want to be cramming the campaign down their throats, especially when you're way, way ahead and all the polls and nobody's really taking your opponent seriously. And before the Tea Party and a lot of other people had discovered Scott Brown and said, hey, here's the way we can still beat health care.
Who wins?
In the end, I think Coakley wins because I think turnout will not be a typical special election. I think it'll be closer to a typical election turnout because the wake-up call came. because of the Rasmussen poll, the PPP poll, the Boston Globe poll was made to look like it was out of touch. And I think also all these ads and everything else that's suddenly being paid for by people from outside the state, millions of dollars flooding in, I think that's probably going to turn out a lot of folks who normally would have stayed home.
I agree with you. One of the reasons Bill Clinton campaigned for Coakley on Friday is because Democrats need that boost in the turnout, and they fear that they don't have the same enthusiasm as the Republicans do.
Well, and if they don't have enthusiasm for Martha Coakley, at least perhaps they can be made to have some enthusiasm for defending the seat of Ted Kennedy, the seat of John Kennedy.
Wait, and Benjamin Smith II?
And a lot of people think of it as Ben's seat. And also, I think the idea of defending the 60-vote majority in the Senate and keeping the health care bill moving along has some force as well.
But even if Brown loses by a close amount, it still sends a signal that it's very possible that the Democrats could be in some sort of trouble in the fall.
Some sort? Yeah. I mean, we're talking about Massachusetts. Maybe they're not going to lose a lot in Massachusetts, but let's talk about the other 49 right. states. I think it's already very clear that there's a big locomotive coming down the track, and that even Democrats like Chris Van Hollen, who is the chairman of the Democratic Campaign Committee, are saying, look, we're going to take a hit here. We're going to lose some. This is a midterm election. The president's got an ambitious agenda. We're at 10% unemployment. We've got two unpopular wars going on. There's no way we don't take a hit in November. The only question now is, how far do the Republicans come back? Do they get the House? Do they cut in half the Democratic majority in the Senate? Do they get back the majority of governorships? Right now, I would say odds are they do get back a majority of governorships. And a year ago, they were down 30-20.
One Senate seat that looks like will certainly go Republicans' way, one Democratic Senate seat, is North Dakota. John Hoeven, the popular three-term governor, announced this week that he will run for Byron Dorgan's seat. Nobody saw Byron Dorgan retiring. And even if he did retire, everybody thought that Earl Pomeroy, the state's at-large congressman, would run, and he's not running.
But only because they didn't know John Hoeven was going to run. He let a deadline go by last September. And when he didn't say he was running last September, then a lot of people started saying, oh, well, Dorgan's safe. A lot of people had it rated right. safe. And then the same people said, and even if he were to retire, there's Pomeroy. Now it looks like Pomeroy's got a pretty tough challenge himself in terms of just being reelected to the House. This is going to be a tough year for Democrats in the Dakotas.
Yeah.
One Senate race where the Republicans are still having a bit of a struggle, even though they should probably wind up holding on to this seat, is in Florida, where Mel Martinez retired prematurely, turned his seat over to an appointee. The appointee's not running.
George Lemieux.
Who was appointed by
Charlie Crist,
who
the governor.
Does want the seat, and of course Lemieux is his placeholder. But before he gets around to beating a Democrat in November and taking over for his placeholder, he's going to have to beat back in a surprisingly strong challenge from Marco Rubio.
This maybe sound like a weird comparison, but Charlie Crist, in a way, is like Hillary Clinton, the presumptive frontrunner for the presidential nomination, not seeing the challenge that Barack Obama brought. Charlie Crist also was very confident, has tons of money. Basically, the Republican establishment in Florida ignored Marco Rubio, the former Speaker of the House. But now Mike Huckabee has endorsed Rubio. Karl Rove says, you know, he's for him. Jim DeMint.
I believe the Tea Party has endorsed Marco Rubio.
That's correct. And also the news of the week is that the straw poll in Pinellas County, which is St. Petersburg, which is
Charlie Crist's home county,
which he 4 years ago when he was running for governor unanimously backed him in the straw poll, went for Rubio 2-1.
Okay, but
I know
straw polls.
I agree.
Are polls among activists? Are
amongst
polls
straws.
Among people who really care a great deal and are really into this particular struggle over the heart, soul, and mind of the Florida Republican Party? That's not necessarily your typical voter, even in a primary, even in Florida. I don't think Crist is out of this thing by any
means. I agree.
I think Crist is probably, in the end, in something of a situation like Martha Coakley, where if he runs a great campaign, gets really in gear, he can probably still mobilize the assets of his natural superiority as a candidate and, in the end, be the Republican nominee.
I agree with you completely, but for now, it's perception, it's headlines, and Rubio seems to be getting the headlines.
That's right. Rubio, though, has not taken a hit yet. It seems to me that he's gotten away with a lot in terms of being able to go after Crist on all the issues. Crist has been trying to push back and saying, you know, Marco Rubio's had some conversions here. You know, when he was in the state legislature, his anti-tax credentials were not so pristine and were not so perfect. And so I think it's going to get to be a slugfest. And in the end, and I think the Republicans still hold on to the seat because I don't think the Democrats are going to nominate somebody who can win statewide.
Well, the Democratic candidate will be Congressman Kendrick Meek, African-American, who I don't think wins statewide, too. But the obverse situation is the case in New York, where the Democratic establishment has rallied behind Kirsten Gillibrand, the appointed senator, and now Harold Ford Jr., you remember that New Yorker from Memphis?
Yeah, that New Yorker from Memphis,
who is talking more and more. He's saying he's seriously considering, but now he's attacking Harry Reid, Charles Schumer, the White House, saying, you know, the party bosses, I'm not going to be bullied, I'm not going to be pushed aside.
Yeah, what's going on here? I think Harold Ford thought he was going to matter in the Obama administration somehow. He took this job after losing in 2006 in his bid for the Senate, took this job with the Democratic Leadership Council, tried to position himself as kind of a moderate in the party, looked for a place for himself in the new Democratic regime under Barack Obama, and came up with what? Pretty much nothing. And so all of this, it seems to me, what we have is a cri de coeur. We have a guy saying, hey, what happened to what was there for Harold?
Yeah, but I don't think it's personal pique that forced him to run against a fellow Democrat.
In the state of New York, though. I mean, why isn't he trying to make a comeback in the state of Tennessee? Why didn't he get a job in the administration? Why is he in New York trying to make what is essentially, it seems to me, a big media splash talking about how he got left out of the goodies when the Obama administration took over?
Well, the point is, he's certainly sounding like a candidate. The Gillibrand people are saying, wait a second, Harold Ford is so out of the mainstream. He's called himself pro-life when he ran for the Senate in Tennessee.
The Democratic mainstream.
The Democratic mainstream, right. He is strong on guns. He's against same-sex
marriage.
He's
a Tennessee Democrat.
But it's interesting to me that the Gillibrand people are criticizing Ford's voting record.
when it's a lot like hers.
Not as conservative.
Well, but it's coming at her from the direction she least expected.
She was pro-guns upstate New York when she was a member of the House for two terms. She was, you know, different views on immigration than she has now. So for her to talk about Harold Ford's out-of-mainstream positions when her positions were not the kind that Manhattan Democrats are crazy about.
Exactly. And the exact people who were looking for an alternative to Gillibrand should not be finding it in a guy who's coming from her right.
Never saw that coming.
But why is he a legitimate threat to her in any sense? Isn't it because, on the one hand, he's African-American, so he is a rallying point for all those who wanted to have a person of color in this seat and were upset at Kirsten Gillibrand getting the appointment?
With Roland Burris gone, there will be no blacks in the Senate.
That is correct. And here's a guy who can come in and say, hey, New York, you rely on this vote, and then you never give any of the nominations to this vote. And you bail out on the ones who do get statewide office, like David Patterson. So he's got an uncomfortable point that he's raising here. And when he brings up Harry Reid, he stomps on the very most sensitive toe in the entire Democratic foot, not just in New York, but nationally.
Ultimately, do you think Ford runs? I say he does not.
No, I think he's making a call to Barack Obama. Yeah. He's saying, how come I haven't had more attention from you? How come my enormous potential, and obviously he's a politician, he's a very attractive guy, he's got a lot going on for him, and he expected something to come his way. Well, I mean, he really ran a great campaign in 2006 and really had some expectation. I think he was ahead about 2 weeks out, 3 weeks out.
Until that famous ad.
And I think he's just very disappointed that he's just as far out of the main action of the Democratic Party as he's been up to the last couple of weeks when he's made a big splash.
It's interesting to see him attack Harry Reid as his party boss who's suppressing democracy. Harry Reid has gotten in some headlines this week.
Yes. Now, what has Harry done? I believe that it's safe to say that it's not anything Harry Reid has done in the last couple, 3 weeks that suddenly made him quite so infamous.
Two years ago.
It's something he said in the fall of 2006, is it not? I mean, 3 years ago, before Barack Obama even declared as a candidate, Harry Reid was encouraging him and telling people he thought Obama could run a good campaign against Hillary. And he made this now famous remark about how Obama would be pretty attractive as a national African-American candidate.
Light-skinned.
Because he was light-skinned and he didn't speak with a Negro dialect. Now, this was ear-catching because apparently Harry Reid was the last person in America to be using the word Negro, or at least in the context and the way in which he was using it.
Yeah, he was complimenting. He was actually saying
this was his idea
support.
Of positive. Yeah, he was saying, thumbs up, Barack. And this has, of course, been an opening for a lot of Republicans who wanted to have a chance to show themselves to be interested in the dignity and the sensitivity and the feelings of African Americans.
But there's hypocrisy there, but there is the charge of a double standard that why Trent Lott?
Two things here. One, Trent Lott got in trouble for saying that the country would have been better off, or implying strongly the country would have been better off, if segregationist Strom Thurmond had been elected president in 1948. And whatever you want to say about how unfair it was to jump on him when he was saying this at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday party and retirement party, the person who put out. Trent Lott from the majority leadership.
What you're about to say is the key to the difference.
The person who read him out of the Republican Party and basically dumped him as
not
Senate
the liberals,
majority leader,
not the African Americans,
was George W. Bush. Right. And George W. Bush got up and gave a speech to an African American group in Philadelphia and said, you know what, this is unacceptable. There's no place for it in our party. Now, if Barack Obama went and did the same thing and said Harry Reid should go, he should not be the Senate majority leader, there's no place for using the word Negro or talking about light-skinned in this party, Harry Reid would be a goner.
Now, there are some people who still think that Harry Reid may be a goner, that, first of all, his son, Rory Reid, is the likely Democratic candidate for governor in Nevada.
Oh, this is so bad.
That's so weird for both of them,
right? Anybody who is a parent can understand the dilemma that Harry Reid is in this whole situation. I mean, he's obviously pushing his son's career. He obviously wants his son to succeed. But it's bad for both of them that they're both on the ballot at the same time running for these two statewide offices. It couldn't be worse.
But, you know, going back to that famous quote, the book is...
The book is Game Change.
The book is Game Change by John Heilman
and Mark Halperin.
It's a great book. You know,
it's a fabulous publicity job. They have done a great job
but
they have done an even better job of getting it out there.
And yet, the stuff on Harry Reid is the least interesting thing about the book.
I mean,
it
should be.
It is, and it
is. But you know it's the most famous thing. And if there are more famous things in this book, there's the Palin stuff. There's the John Edwards stuff.
John and Elizabeth Edwards.
Oh, it is.
When I first heard about this book, I said, oh, not another campaign, not another 2008. This is 2010 already. I want to see what's going on 2010, 2012. We know that Hillary didn't get the nomination. We know Barack Obama got the nomination. And yet, there's stuff there, whether it's true or not, whether the quotes are, you know, that's a little PS here.
Have you heard anybody yet say, I never said that?
Sarah Palin.
All right. Sarah Palin said she never said those things that are being attributed to her.
That she didn't know there was a difference between North and South Korea.
But that's not coming from her. That's coming from Steve Schmidt and other people like Steve Schmidt that are saying that she didn't know the difference.
Right.
So what I'm saying, did anybody who has been quoted in the book emerge yet to say, I never said that? I don't believe so. I think what people have said was, ooh, I thought that was off the record, or ooh.
Which is the case with Reid.
I didn't realize any of that was going to be, you know, printed.
But when you read that the people who were giving lip service to the Clintons, especially to Hillary Clinton, our chances for the nomination, and then saying to Barack Obama, look, you know, she's a disaster for the party. She would bring our party down. We really want you to run. It was Schumer. It was Reid. It was all these people who ostensibly were neutral.
Do you think she's surprised? Do you think there's a name in there that surprises her?
No, but you know how the Clintons can be when they're spurned. You saw what Bill did, reacted to Bill Richardson when Bill Richardson endorsed Obama. He used to be the governor of New Mexico. Talk about truth or consequences.
Okay, yeah.
But I just think that it's inside baseball. It's political nerds who love the book. But there's just so much detail in there that I said, oh, my goodness, I just could not get enough of it.
All right. There are a lot of other things going on in politics this week. We need to mention just briefly in a governor's race in Colorado. Last week, we were talking about how Bill Ritter had suddenly and surprisingly stepped down as the Democratic presumed candidate this fall. John Hickenlooper, the interesting
and very popular,
charismatic mayor of Denver, has suddenly stepped into this race.
And I know the first question, Ron, you want to ask me is it true that John Hickenlooper is related to former Iowa Senator Burke B. Hickenlooper?
Which was the first question I asked the good mayor when I met him in 2008.
And the answer is yes, they are distant cousins.
They are distant cousins, although Mr. Hickenlooper was originally, I believe, from Indiana before he moved to Colorado to open a brew pub.
That's right.
Actually, he initially went there to be an energy engineer, and then later, when the energy industry tanked, he went into brew pubbing.
If either party wants to present a non-political persona in 2010, because we all hate politicians.
Oh, we hate them.
Hickenlooper would be a great candidate, even though he is a bit liberal.
And even though he is
statewide,
the mayor of Denver, which usually is not the ticket to being elected governor of Colorado. All right. Down in South Carolina, I guess Mark Sanford's finally out of the woods now.
Well, he has been censured by the House, in the State House, but the State Senate, as of this podcast, has tabled that resolution. So it looks like he will be wandering the trail for another year.
So it is possible for him to just sort of go quietly into that good night. I mean, his term will just end. They'll elect someone else in his place, and Mark Sanford will be finished and done.
Ron, on health care, it seems like everybody was focusing on the Senate's inability to get 60 votes or to nail down 60 votes, but Democrats in the House seem to be having difficulty getting 218.
Well, as well they should, because so much of what the Democrats in the House cared about in the bill, what people who really cared about health care, quote, reform, unquote, cared about all along has been sacrificed in the Senate bill. There's no public option. There's not even an opt-in, opt-out kind of public option. It is, by any measure, much less friendly to the kinds of issues and to some of the Democratic interest groups, such as organized labor.
Right.
No wonder a lot of people in the House are saying, what are we voting for this for? This is going to be worse for us politically than no bill at all. All right, now cue the music, cue the Dixieland music. We're going to go out here with a mention of a new development in the mayoral race in our favorite American city.
We've spent a lot of this podcast talking about race. You cannot avoid talking about race when you talk about New Orleans politics, and especially since Katrina, when the whole dynamic of race has shifted. There has not been a white mayor of New Orleans since Moon Landrieu, who was a mayor in the 1970s. Of course, his daughter is Senator Mary Landrieu. His son is Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu.
What a coincidence.
Yes, same last name, right?
And
Mitch Landrieu is making his third bid for the mayoralty this year. The election is February 6th, but the leading African-American candidate in the primary is a state senator by the name of Ed Murray, who announced that he will not run. What African-Americans always had in New Orleans is that even though the business establishment was always white-owned, the blacks always had the mayoralty, at least since Moon Landrieu left in the 1970s. If Mitch Landrieu is going to be elected mayor this year, black political power decreases even further in the city.
Well, and so many people had their neighborhoods inundated or in some sense or another destroyed by Katrina so that they moved out. They literally left. The voting power of African Americans in New Orleans was also enormously decreased by Katrina and by everything that came after. And the number of people who left the city and have yet to return, although many may eventually, they haven't yet. So this is a different electorate that we're seeing in New Orleans.
And the thought of Mitch Landrieu winning is probably anathema to many conservative white voters, because even though Landrieu ran against a black candidate, Ray Nagin, 4 years ago, the conservative white establishment so despises the Landrieu name in Louisiana and New Orleans that they were even willing to vote for Ray Nagin 4 years ago.
That's right. Now Ray Nagin, of course, is term limited out and can't return. So this is an interesting race in terms of New Orleans' future and in terms of the further politics of Louisiana. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.